I'm sorry, you were saying how difficult you...
The difficulties you experienced with the Kurds in the north.
Well, it was very much a political thing, but to try to get unity amongst the Kurds, which would have been very helpful, was almost impossible because they were at each other's throats. And some of them were, you know, particularly...
So this bodes ill, possibly, for the present situation?
Well, I mean, it makes it very clear that the country itself is divided into at least three dimensions. There's the Kurdish and the Shias and so on. And, you know, if you remember that the Marsh Arabs, as Saddam sort of gradually settled back in, then the problem of the Marsh Arabs came up and what he was doing to them. And that's when we had to put aeroplanes down into the southern no-fly zone, which I went out there in August, I think it was, 91, to see our first tornadoes arrive at Dharan. And there we were back again, you know, about 3 or 4 months after we'd left. We were back policing the southern no-fly zone as well.
With the Americans again?
With the Americans. I don't think the French were on that one. I think it was just the Americans there. Probably.
And presumably your work in NATO, dealing with principally the Americans but others, of course, must have stood you in good stead?
It did, actually. I'll give you an example of that. I think it was when I was CNC Strike Command. Two little stories, actually. One quite amusing one. I went out there to visit, I think it must have been the first time, but maybe it was the second, with Archie Hamilton, who was then the Minister for Armed Forces. He wanted to go and see all this. And we flew into a Turkish base, and there was this great honour guard. And, you know, Archie Hamilton thought it was for him. Absolutely was it not for him. It was for me, because I was a general and he was just a civilian. And generals count in Turkey. So he was told to sort of get back while I took. And it was really quite funny the rest of the day, seeing how the Turks operated there. But we had a problem with the Turkish Air Force at the time, or the controllers, who would not let us refuel as we needed to do with our Jaguars, who found it quite difficult to get to the height that was necessary, and that meant the range was, so they had to refuel earlier than the brackets that the Turks had agreed that they could use. And you know, the Turks are very neurotic about security. They think everybody's trying to spy on them and whatever. And you know, this was just a simple fact of life that they needed the fuel at that position rather than further on where our other aeroplanes could do it, because they had better performance at higher level. And we were getting nowhere, and it was really becoming quite a problem. And I was able to ring up a chap that I'd served with in NATO, and who was then the commander of their air force in that part of the world. I forgot what his name was now. He eventually became their chief, I think. And say, look, we've got a problem. And this is what it is. And he said, oh, yeah, I understand. Fine. He said, I think I'll do something about it. So he did. But if we'd gone through the system into the, as we were doing through the Foreign Office, we'd never have got that sorted out, because it would have got blocked by the generals in Ankara, who didn't know anything about it. But airman to airman, NATO guy to NATO guy, you could get things sorted.
And to what extent, then, were the military in control in Turkey? Were they totally in control then, before they went back to the civilian?
In that time, Evren had just given up, but he was still a very powerful...
Right.
Behind the throne. And the Turkish general staff were standing very, very close to the government, because the government had had ups and downs, and I think they had one or two problems. I'm just trying to remember whether Mrs. whatever her name was, do you remember the Schiller?
No,
was right. She hadn't arrived then, she came a bit later. They were immensely powerful, although they'd taken their hands off the actual reins of government.
But most of the time you spent in the UK?
We did a fair bit of travelling around, seeing colleagues, you know, in the Air Force, in the operation. Went to America and... Yes, I was what was called Commander-in-Chief UK Air, which was a NATO appointment. There were four regions in the central region. In the NATO Allied Command Europe. So there was Supreme Allied Command of Europe, who'd been my old boss when I was at NATO, a chap called Jack Galvin. And when I became CNC UK Air, I joined the Central Region Commander, Northern and Southern Region Commanders, the four principal subordinate commands, as they were called. which was really quite amazing, because in sort of 2 years I'd gone from being the two-star chap working for Jack Galvin to being one of his sort of peers on this group, which was amazing. And it was very enjoyable, nice people to work with, but knowing the system was very helpful.
Yes. Yes. While we were at Strike Command, you said that you dealt with the tail end of the First Gulf War.
Yeah.
You were clearly addressing the beginning or the middle of this first
tranche of drawdown. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Which involved redundancies?
There were mainly volunteer redundancies then. I think we were able to... The numbers of people that the RAF lost, manpower-wise, was not huge. And I think nearly all of those were done on a voluntary basis. There were very, very few. I'm pretty sure that we didn't have any compulsory redundancies then. There was certainly... The army had many more. I do remember that. And that was a source of some grief to them. They had to do that.
How did you address the morale question, which probably arose at all levels of the service, where you mentioned that we might have five wing commanders, now we're only going to have one, or whatever it may be. How did you address that question?
I think at that stage, the implications of all that had not really become that clear. Because I say the manpower numbers are not drawn down that much, and we were still in the process of moving the bases, and so I don't think anybody was. It wasn't the abiding concern at the time. What was a bigger concern was the fact that the defence budget seemed to be totally under threat. So just when you thought that you got something coherent together, then you were being asked for another major slice of something. And the time I spent at Strike Command was all desperately trying to get budgets to... introducing budgets at the same time, trying to control them with the things that we were being asked to do. Because, as I told you, we were already committed to operating airplanes in Turkey and in Saudi Arabia in support of UN resolutions over Iraq, in addition to the Falklands, in addition to, I don't know, all the various things that... and this was at a time when we were drawing down the numbers of frontline airplanes, consequently pilots. So they were getting quite busy. And that was the start, really, of I suppose, the first signs of perhaps the overstretch that was going to come.
Well, we'll come on to... I was about to mention it then, but we'll come on to that perhaps later.
Now, I have to make a swift phone call in about 2 minutes, if you don't mind.
Well, we'll...
Shall we stop that there?
We'll stop now. Yes.
It seemed to be a constant battle to save money.
Yes.
Rather than perhaps what one would hope, if you're in charge of the Premier Operational Command in the Royal Air Force, to focus on your ability to conduct war. I have to say that as much of my time there was spent worrying about how we were going to actually make the budget work and the savings that we were required to make without drastically reducing the numbers of flying hours that our people could fly. Taking on, support by cutting down on spares and things like that. At the same time, making closing stations and doing all of that. It was a period which I suppose prepared me or gave me a pretty good insight into what I was likely to have when I became CAS, if I did become CAS, because it just seemed to me to be an ongoing thing. The government was requiring its pound of flesh year on year on year.
Whilst increasing its commitments.
Yes, I mean, at the time when I was at Strike Command, I guess we would not have identified it as overstretch, but I think in retrospect I can see that the writing was a bit on the wall then.
Right. Towards the end of Strike Command, presumably, you were interviewed for, it was suggested that. How did it come about that you might be in the running for Chief of the Air Staff?
Well, I guess, see, I went there in April 91, and we were still waiting to see The key to it, a key to it, was whether the then Chief Defence Staff, who was Dick Vincent, would be succeeded by Peter Harding, who was my predecessor, or the sailor, what was his name? Nice man. Oswald, Julian Oswald. That was the two horses running in that one, I think. And that was clearly not going to be known until much later that second summer, i.e. 92. But the debate was clearly taking place between Peter Harding and his closest confidant, who was actually a chap called Benny Jackson at the time. I'd taken over from Benny in NATO at SHAPE. He's a splendid man, really splendid man, with no pretensions himself to be CAS, but he was very much the elder statesman, and I think Peter Harding certainly relied hugely on him for advice and all of that. And I remember Benny saying to me, very indiscreetly, because he was extremely indiscreet on occasion, that I looked to be the favoured heir. And this was actually, you know, almost in the spring of 92, which surprised me, and I didn't actually take it too seriously at the time, because I couldn't really see on what basis that decision could have been made at that stage. You know, we were still wrestling, me with various things in Strike Command. But I think, in retrospect, what might have tipped the balance, and I can only guess on this one, is I initiated a study into the air defences of the United Kingdom, because it was obvious to me that we really had to make some changes to that in the light of the totally changed strategic environment. The air defences of the United Kingdom are a bit of an icon for defence of the realm, if you like, you know, Battle of Britain and all of that, and throughout the Cold War, critically important. And it was certainly my experience. I was brought up in the air defence world, so if anybody could look at it with knowledge, I think I could. And I gave the responsibility with, I hope, some reasonable guidelines to John Allison, who was by then the AOC 11 group. And I said, John, you know, we've got to really do a job on this one. I think we can provide an adequate air defence for today's needs, which we could use to rebound if anything ever went wrong again, if there was a resurgence. But we've got to mothball awful lot of radar stations. We've got to really, you know, close some bases and do some things here and really cut back on it. It's not justified. And John came up with a study which we looked at. And although the study was not in intimate detail, I think it was a far-sighted visionary study of what we could do over a period of time sensibly and still give ourselves resurgent capability. And I remember briefing that to Peter Harding in his office with the rest of the Air Force Board. I bet he was still around, you know, quite early on. I've only been there 6 months or something like that. And being attacked by one or two of my colleagues saying, you haven't gone into this in adequate detail and blah, blah, blah. And I made the point that unless you actually knew where you wanted to go, you could actually get wound up in so much detail, you'd never actually get yourself to where. And I think Peter Harding, a man who always thought widely, realised that I actually did have a vision, and that was what was required, rather than getting into nitty-gritty detail on things and sometimes losing your way. And I think possibly in retrospect that was a turning point in assessment. That's my guess. I don't know. I never asked him.
So that is really as late as very late 91 then, only 6 months after you were there, April 91, you
probably
joined Strike Command.
late 91, early 92, when we were doing that sort of activity. But it's all part, going back to what I was talking about, of trying to find ways of making major savings, because, you know, that was the only way we were going to make our budgets balance. So we had some, you know, drastic things to do and some real sacred cows to slaughter, and, particularly in things like air defence. Anyway, there we were. But come, I think, September... No, it was a bit earlier than that, wasn't it? I think it was probably about July. Anyway, I was told by Peter Harding that I would take over from him.
At the end of that year, or...?
Take over at the end of October, I think.
Right.
Because he was going to take over as Chief of Defence Staff in January the following year.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. During this time, in the rarefied reaches of the Air Force, was it a good thing to do, and did you do it, or did it never happen, to try and cultivate political friends at court? Because would it be the case that you are, and this is the underlying subtext of the question, that you are no longer dealing purely in just sort of military stuff, but it's more and more politics, you've been forced to become more and more an economist,
yes.
And now more and more a political animal. Would that be the case?
I think that's an extremely interesting question. I think it's actually very pertinent. And I would have to say that as far as I was concerned, I had no real political contact because I'd not been in Whitehall for quite some time. And if I had, I would have done. And I think whether I would have chosen them or whether it would have just been happenstance, I don't know. But your point is entirely valid, and I think it's probably worthy of comment in here, is that the best operators in Whitehall, and I can think of a few, and usually the army, but not always, are very astute at cultivating the political thing. I mean, they sometimes get it wrong, you know, you're careful you don't back the wrong horse there. It's never really been my style to cultivate politicians. I think I, maybe lack of opportunity. Where I was well known was in the NATO and diplomatic side of things because of the experience I'd had there. So I think people did know of me there rather than particularly in Whitehall. I mean, Tom King, I really didn't know. And I have to say, I found him a bore. I went when I was first CNC Strike Command, I was summoned to see him, which was not unreasonable as we were still, you know, doing things quite important in the Middle East to talk about that. And I was summoned to Westminster, not to his office, to Westminster about 2:30 in the afternoon, and eventually he saw me at 4 o'clock. You know, he just kept me waiting for an hour and a half. Now, I may have been very busy, but the whole point of going to Westminster, as opposed to his office, presumably, was because that would be convenient for him. Fine.
You know, and away from the civil servants, possibly.
Hmm?
And away from the civil servants, possibly.
Well, maybe, I don't know, but, you know, it just struck me as the height of bad manners to keep people waiting that long. And never even an apology. I mean, man was... but he had a reputation like that, so I don't think I was alone in thinking he was a bore.
Right. Mm. Did you set out... So you're starting off in this very senior job without too many political friends at court, if I can call...
Yeah.
Did you set out to try and rapidly replenish your limited supplies, or how did you approach it?
I don't think I consciously went out of my way, and probably mistakenly to have friends in the political arena. It was more people that I liked. I got on very well, for example, with Robert Cranbourne, who very early on I met, and I think we clicked. We liked each other. I certainly found him a very straightforward and decent man. By the time I got to CAS, Malcolm Rifkin was in the office as Secretary of State. I'd met him, he'd been to Strike Command, I'd briefed him there. And I think I'd not be alone in saying that he was a man who was quite difficult to get to know. I don't think anybody got to know him. I mean, even the most astute army officer never got to know Malcolm Rifkin. He wasn't the man you got to know. So I don't think there was any close relationship with him at all. I've forgotten who else. Archie Hamilton was Min AF. And yeah, I got on fine with Archie, but I didn't think we were ever a bit close. He was an ex-guardsman, so he lived in that sort of, you know, very tall, very rarefied. Didn't really understand the Air Force. And I'm trying to remember, okay, it was old Clark, the dreaded Clark, Alan Clark, who was Minister for Defence Procurement. And I mean, nobody knew Alan Clark because he wasn't interested in knowing anybody in the military. He was only interested in Alan Clark. So to answer your question, I think Robert Cranbourne was the man that I found I could do business with best. I certainly did go and see him more than any other minister when I was there.
and senior civil servants like permanent undersecretaries?
Yeah, well, I knew all those guys because I'd grown up with them in one way or another.
Right.
Christopher France, who was then permanent undersecretary, was a civil servant from the old school. You know, I consider admirable man, absolutely honest, straight, there to serve the services, no agendas. Very, very good man. The second permanent secretary was a chap called Murray Stewart, who we'd known for years, was quite a character. But one could find the soft side of Murray with enough of a good red wine, I think. a clever man. I mean, people don't get to that sort of position without being very, very bright.
No. And there is the old adage that you should always keep an eye out for the people who are down because one day they're going to be on the way up. So did you have any contact at all with the Labour front bench opposition?
Yeah. Not initially, but I personally, I'm not a natural conservative, put it that way.
Large C.
Sorry?
Large C.
Large C.
Yes.
And so my experience has always been, not always been, Margaret Thatcher should be accepted for the first 4 years of her reign, but I've always thought the Conservatives talk a much better game than they play when it comes to defence. If you actually look at what they spend on defence and the cuts they made to defence overall, you'll find that Labour has done rather better for defence, which is not something that many people would normally recognise, but those who worked in Whitehall would. And so I think, particularly bearing in mind, you know, that the government that John Major took over about the time that I became chief was a government that was not a very coherent government. I had a very modest majority, as you know, and it was in parlous state, both in terms of its relations with each other, having had all the traumas of the succession, and also with an economy that was pretty rocky, recessions and God knows what, you know, at hand. A government in disarray and whatever. And I should think certainly within a year or 18 months of being there, we would... we had asked, and indeed the opposition, the Labour, but also the Liberals, had their defence spokesman, and we were more than happy to brief them. And then the Conservatives, who were neurotic about many things, alleged that these briefings were being abused by Labour in particular. So we were not allowed to brief them, which was ridiculous. You know, in a democracy, if you don't have an informed opposition, then what do you have? So we would make arrangements to brief them in other ways, basically, usually through the auspices of third parties and lunches and dinners and things like that, at which they would happen to be, or we would have them for dinner at our flat. No reason why we shouldn't. The government didn't like it, but they couldn't stop us inviting them. So we did over a period of time. For example, David Clark was the opposition spokesman on defence, and John Reid was also interested, and we got to know both of those quite well over that period.
We all know that the major government, I think the word incoherent is a polite and diplomatic way to describe it. I am surprised that you apply, perhaps not the word incoherent, but that Malcolm Rifkind always struck one, as an outside observer, as being someone who was a very safe pair of hands and on whom one could rely, not always for the correct decision, possibly, or one with which you agreed, but it will be a good and rational and well argued decision. Would that be an assessment of him as Secretary of State for Defence or not?
Well, firstly, let me say that this is a man of huge intellect, very, very clever, articulate, and someone that I think all of us who served at that time would trust no further we could throw him when it came to something that really mattered. I've seen him take a stand on an issue for which one might thank him, But when I analysed it later, it didn't actually affect him. If it was ever to an issue that would affect him, his position and his ambitions, he would avoid taking a decision. I would be very surprised if he would have been half as resilient as Labour defence secretaries were, for example, in Kosovo, Bosnia, most recently in Iraq. I just don't think he was of that stature. He was a great man for blowing where the wind would advance him.
Yes.
That's not my view alone. You know, I don't think there's a chief of staff at the time who wouldn't agree entirely with that analysis. Where's all this stuff go, Stanley? It goes into the archives.
It all goes into tomorrow's Times.
Yes,
quite.
The single source.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, we'll conclude just with this on Rifkind. It's interesting that one should hear your views on Rifkind, if only because, of course, he's attempting a comeback.
Absolutely.
Perhaps as the member for Windsor or somewhere, wherever he might, something like that.
Well, don't underestimate two things: his cunning, his intellect, and his ambition. That's three things, but they're all tied up. He's a hugely ambitious man, brilliantly clever. But I'll give you an example of where his sheer cleverness would really grate. He was giving us a bloody awful time on a number of things. And the Air Force was going through a particularly traumatic time for a number of reasons. I can't remember what particular thing the newspapers have been having a go at us at there. And he decided, we had a dinner at Bentley Priory, which he decided that he would come and preside at, which was absolutely right. The Defence Secretary should preside at Air Force Board, Army Board. He'd never actually come to one before, even though we'd invited many times, but he actually decided he'd come to this one, and the guests had all been invited, and a whole range of, great and good coming to dinner at Bentley Priory, a wonderful place. And so out he comes to this dinner, and, he's tremendously hail fellow, well met before dinner and whatever. And then at 9 o'clock, about dinner's just starting to get going, he says, "Well, I'm terribly sorry, I've got to leave now, but I'd just like to say a few words." Now, it was quite reasonable, I suppose, was it, that he had to leave at 9 o'clock? I mean, halfway through dinner, barely started, I would think, because he had to get back to London to vote. I find it astounding he couldn't have paired. But anyway, that's what he did. So I looked at that. He hadn't told me he was going to do this. And then he stood up, and he gushed all about how wonderful the Royal Air Force was and what a fantastic bunch of people they were and, blah, blah, blah. And it was so demonstrably not from the heart that I looked around the table at and I knew a particular lady who was there called Sue Tinson. And at the end of it, there was this sort of rather embarrassed silence, and off he went, so thank you very much, Secretary of State, for coming and all that sort of stuff. And she said to me, "What the bloody hell was all that about?" I mean, it was demonstrably false. And, they all knew around that table that he'd been legging us. Left, right and centre, and he stood up and given this thing. I mean, it was crass stupidity, because they saw straight through it. It was all about, "I really love the Royal Air Force, and I'm only doing it for their own good," sort of thing, blah, blah, blah. No.
Options for change.
We'll come to that.
We'll come to options for change, yes. Mm. So, you take over as Chief of Air Staff in October 92.
Yes.
And I suspect you have an idea of what's going to meet you on your first day, a list of stuff that's absolutely got to be done. But can you tell me what that was and whether you were surprised by it?
I think I was very clear, Peter Harding had briefed me on this as well, that I was going to have the task of following through on the drawdown of the Royal Air Force. As I say, it was barely happening because it was due to take place a period of time. I was going to have to oversee the withdrawal from Germany. All the bases in Germany. No, that's not true. Half the bases in Germany were to be closed, and the command itself was to be well, would withdrawn, would be absorbed within Strike Command. We were going to, because a study had concluded that we would form, we would do away with the Air Force Board members, Air Member for Personnel, Air Member for Supply and Organization, and they would be absorbed into two new commands, in addition to Strike Command, which would stay, absorbing Germany. The personnel air, the Air Member for Personnel would become Commander-in-Chief Personnel and Training Command, so taking away half of Support Command and putting it into that, and doing the job as an Air Force Board member, and be sent down to Gloucester to do it all from. And a Logistics Command would be formed at Brampton, which is where Support Command had been, which would take away the responsibilities for the Air Member for Supply and Organization, who would combine all of that Air Force Board.